Are we gain an insight into the world of Gary Trudeau and his cartoon creations. Fellow cartoonists give their interpretations of the Doonesbury world, while Joe Queenan strolls around the studio picking up miniature versions of Mao Tse-tung and G.I. George. Doonesbury Land is at 11:30. But now on Radio 4, the journalist John Ronson continues his series by asking why we feel the need to show off. Today's programme is called John Ronson on Being Fancy.
One day when Elliot Castro was 5, he told the children in the playground that he was a wizard.
Well, I had a twig as a magic wand, and they seemed to think that there was a possibility I could be a wizard.
So did they say, prove it?
Yeah, they said, well, go on, do something magic, you know. And I don't recall exactly, but I said I would set something alight or something stupid like that. And waved the wand, and obviously it didn't happen, so... There was kind of like a wooded area in the playground that you could go into. It was like bushes and stuff like that. And I left the bushes sort of red-faced.
Elliot says he was almost as surprised as the other kids that day when fire didn't come out of his twig.
Oh, was that your school?
Yeah, this is the first school I went to in Glasgow. Battlefield Primary School.
So, can you pull over for a second, just so we can have a look at the school?
I used to come out of here every day, and it would be the same thing every day. Like, a friend of the family lived just up the street there, and this one guy that I had a lot of trouble with used to chase me every day after school, so I'd come out here and I'd run straight up that hill that you can see behind you, and sometimes he would catch me and sometimes I would get away. You know, if he caught me, then I got a kick in. If he didn't, then I was fine.
Elliot didn't know where all this lying and fantasising was going. He was just doing it. He didn't realise that this was his apprenticeship. And then, one day, when he was 8, he got to go on a plane journey to South America with his family. In the middle of the flight, when it was dark and everyone was asleep, he took a walk down to the curtain that separates economy from business class.
I went and had a look behind the curtain, and it was just a completely different plane, basically. You know, it was like massive leather seats. And there were actually people sitting drinking champagne.
Did you notice the extra leg room as well?
I mean, I was only a kid at the time, so I wasn't really bothered about things like leg room.
Yeah. I think Elliot realised something that night on the plane that a lot of people discover to their sorrow at some point in their lives. When you see how fantastic business class is, it's really hard to go back. Here's the writer, Charlie Brooker.
I'd never flown first class anywhere, and then I was going somewhere and they just upgraded me without warning. I was just suddenly ushered into the first class section. I sat there and I was partly appalled by the fact that I suddenly had nice cutlery and a large bed to lie in. And then on the flight back, I was just in regular economy and, you know, I'm instantly like, this is intolerable. I'm never flying economy again because this is awful. And so I have to go in the first class carriage on trains if I possibly can, just because...
You've done it once.
Yeah, and then I've sat in sort of standing class and been sick on. And, you know, obviously that's my worst nightmare.
But surely, you know, those trains where the first class carriage is just a tiny little... A snob box, you know, a tiny little box.
Oh, no,
all the second class people.
Well, you sit in there, you buy a standard ticket and sit in it anyway. And that way you've won. It's like they've given you a special fancy hat to wear. Or you've been given a coloured napkin for this train journey. It's because you can see everybody else and everybody else can see you. Crucially, on a regular first-class carriage, it's separated, isn't it, by the buffet car.
The sight of the business-class cabin behind the curtain on the flight to Chile burnt itself into 8-year-old Elliot Castro's mind. He knew at that moment that this was to be his life. He wouldn't be someone who got chased up the road by bullies. He'd be someone who'd drink champagne in first class. He just didn't know how to achieve it.
It was things like when my mum would take us to buy school clothes and stuff like that. She would want to go to, like, CNA and I would want to have to go to Marks and Spencer's, right? And I think that sort of feeling has always been there.
And
I'm not sure it will ever go away, to be honest. I think I've always wanted to be better.
And you started working in a call centre.
Yeah, I started working in a call centre, actually just up the street from where we are just now. And my job was to sell mobile phones to people and take all their details and process the order.
This wasn't what Elliot had in mind when he foresaw a fancy first-class life for himself. Pretty soon he'd have a brainwave, a brilliant scheme to realise all his dreams. But before I tell you what the brainwave was, try and understand what Elliot was so desperate to leave behind. Life in a call centre. Here's the Canadian writer Jonathan Goldstein, who himself used to have a career in telemarketing, selling the Montreal Gazette newspaper over the telephone.
When you're a little kid, you never decide that one day you're going to be a telemarketer. It's not something that you plan. It just happens. Like the way going bald just happens. Or the way falling down a flight of stairs just happens. One minute you're at the top of the landing, and the next, you're at the bottom. As you might expect, the hard thing about working at the Gazette was that there was just so much rejection. Even though you were calling almost 200 people a day, 98% of whom wanted to see you dead, you still had to bring a certain hopefulness to each call. A feeling that this one, the call you were making right now, could be the one. In the pitching room, we all wore these headsets that were connected to computers. As soon as we hung up, the computer automatically dialed the next number, so that we were always speaking to someone without respite. Our boss was a man named Ray, and if you made two or three sales a day, then you were doing okay, and Ray wouldn't scream at you. Generally, I found the repetitiousness of the job comforting. You're never at a loss for words. You always know what you're going to say. Because what you're going to say is, "Hi, my name is Jonathan, and I wanted to know if you're interested in reading the Gazette newspaper." One time a woman who answered the phone would not believe I wasn't a friend of hers named Christopher. "Stop playing around, Christopher," she said. "But I'm not Christopher," I responded. "Will you cut it out, Christopher?" After several minutes of this, I had to hang up on her. I knew that Christopher was going to get it for that. From my very first week at the Gazette, I was surprised to discover that I had a natural gift for sales. Whatever I was and whatever aspirations I had before I started working there, I became an instant Gazette legend, sometimes selling up to 10 subscriptions in the course of a shift. There was a bell on Ray's desk for when you made a sale, and when I made a sale, I had a special way of hitting it with the balls of my fingers that made it sound as crisp and clean as a glockenspiel. I always kept to the one-tap-per-sale rule. I respected the bell, not like some of the other guys who rang the crap out of it like they were 5-year-olds riding their first two-wheeler. Eventually, as happens to all the mighty, I fell. Even now I can't explain it. Hubris, my diet. Perhaps I started taking myself too seriously and lost my sense of fun. Who knows? It's a very real thing, the stink of desperation. It's an actual odor, and people can smell it over the phone line. Your jokes become a little more hurried and forced, your confidence a little more false, your pauses more awkward. A few weeks ago, I got home and found this on my answering machine.
Hello?
When the telemarketer realized that there was no one there to pitch to, he stopped himself. But I want you to listen again and notice the long pause before he actually puts the phone down.
Hello?
He says hello, he inhales, and before he puts the phone down, he pauses. As someone who's sold over the telephone for close to 10 years, I can tell you that the pause between the hello and the hang-up is a moment of reprieve. You start to talk, you realize you've gotten an answering machine, and then before you actually hang up, you steal a moment. You take shelter in those few seconds before you hit the hang-up button, and the onslaught of automatically dialed phone numbers begins anew, delivering the voices of people who will very soon hate you directly into the earphones of your headset and straight into your brain.
Jonathan Goldstein, who spent 10 years working in a call centre. His story of his life in telemarketing first appeared on the show This American Life, produced by Chicago Public Radio. Elliot Castro only managed 2 weeks in telemarketing. He became concerned that his life was slipping by and he wasn't fulfilling his ambitions, and so he decided to take drastic measures to change that. Credit card fraud.
What I'd realised was that I could actually get the person, by telling them that the card had been referred to the credit card company, I could actually put them on hold. come back to them and say, right, I've got the card company on the line and they want to know X details, i.e. mother's maiden name. 99 times out of 100, they gave me the details and I ended up having a notebook filled with these details.
So you crossed the line?
I think at that point, yeah. I think that's when it all sort of began, yeah. I mean, I wasn't sure at that time what I was going to do with these details, but I think it was quite obvious where I was going to go from there. If I, for example, John, if I asked you over the phone to tell me your credit card details, and if you gave me this information, I could then call your bank and make changes to your account, i.e. change the address and have a new card sent out to that address, or a number of different things.
After 2 weeks, Elliot was fired from the call centre. So they told you to clear your desk?
Yes.
And what did you take?
Well, just the notebook, that was it.
Gosh, how old were you?
I think I was 17 or 18 when I did that. I remember asking my mum at one point as well about credit cards, and because I was interested to know, you know, what did happen if someone stole your credit card and used it. And, I mean, what she said to me at the time was, she said, well, I would cancel it. And I said, no, but, I mean, what happens if they use it to buy something? Do you have to pay for it? And she said, no, because the bank will just cover it.
Yeah, he did. He did. And if I'd known why he was asking me that, I would have maybe elaborated a bit more.
What did you say?
I just said, well, they get their money back. But I didn't go into all the stress that people would have, you know, someone stole their credit card and things. As I say, if I'd known...
Why he was asking,
then, yeah, I would have went into it a lot more.
And so, with a clear conscience and a pocket full of stolen credit cards with unlimited funds, Elliot went to London.
I'd always, like, looked at maps of London when I was a kid and sort of, I want to go there. I wanted to go to Buckingham Palace, Madame Tussauds, House of Commons, and, you know, various other sort of landmarks in London. And when I went down to London, it was crazy. I really liked it the first time I went. I even took photographs of me on the underground. I got, like, someone sitting opposite me to take a photograph of me at Piccadilly Circus Station, you know. I've still got the photo at home. It's just me sitting with a proper cheeser, smiling away with the Piccadilly Circus sign behind me, you know. It's just really stupid kid stuff. But I did do a bit of shopping on Bond Street and ended up buying some stuff, like just clothes and stuff.
What labels?
I bought a Gucci belt that was £300, a Louis Vuitton bag that was about £500 or £600. I desperately wanted to be part of the idol rich, you know, that I could just go out and buy whatever I wanted.
That night, Elliot found himself in a bar on Park Lane, quaffing champagne.
I met two city bankers. I told them, sort of ironically enough, that I worked for American Express. And the night just went pretty well, actually. We drank about 3 or 4 bottles of champagne between us. And I had a great night, you know. It was like, for that one night, I felt as if that was exactly where I wanted to be, you know, mingling with these sort of people.
Did you feel, you know, you could look at the old kids from the neighbourhood and think, look, you thought I wouldn't make it, but look at me now?
There was definitely a bit of that. You know, I was taunted quite a lot and I was bullied quite a lot at school. And for me, you know, the fact that I was now doing all these things, it was kind of a statement, look at me now, check me out, you know.
But of course, it was just a fantasy. You were sitting there quaffing champagne in Park Lane. Mm. But that wasn't what you were.
No.
What you actually was somebody who stole a credit card.
Yeah, well, you're absolutely right. But there was a part of me that just began to believe these things for myself. But I did desperately want to believe that this was who I was, and I was perfectly entitled to be sitting in that bar drinking that champagne.
And that's how it began.
My agenda was to get to as many places as I could. I went to Canada, went to New York 3 times, Miami, France, pretty much all around Europe, Australia, South America, Far East, just everywhere I went, I was on first class flights pretty much. Or if it wasn't first class, it would be club class. It would just depend on the circumstances and whether or not the card would allow it or whatever, you know. Because, I mean, first-class flights, you know, sometimes cost up to, like, £10,000-£12,000, so it wasn't always practicable to sort of...
Well, that'd be putting somebody over their limit, right?
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I had to be careful because I didn't want to alert the credit card companies.
Elliot also didn't want to alert his mum, Jane, although he couldn't help himself.
Mothers know things. I thought, okay, but as long as he's not getting into trouble and you kind of put it to the back of your head, but...
What sort of clues were there?
Where was he getting all this money?
And he was sending you perfume, wasn't he?
Yeah.
How much perfume?
Quite a few bottles of Chanel No. 5. And I would get flowers. these huge bouquets of flowers. My friend owns a florist. I know the price of flowers, and I'm like, okay, this isn't your £15 interflora bunch, you know? And I did say, Elliot, you have to stop sending me these things, because I didn't want to be part of whatever. But then it hurt him, me saying that to him. Okay, it transpires that as far as Ellie was concerned, this was his work. This was a job.
Wasn't there a 4 or 5 day period in Edinburgh where he spent £42,000?
Yeah, I think I was there for, it was either 3 or 4 days.
Including a £12,110 Rolex Oyster President watch.
Yes.
Is that like the king of watches?
I'd say it's pretty up there with him, yeah. I've seen Rolexes that are like £100,000 and stuff like that, but that's like certainly one of the more expensive models.
What does it look like?
It's beautiful. It's solid gold, and it had baguette diamonds at the 12, 3, 6 and 9 points, and miniature diamonds at all the other points on the face. Basically, that watch, you could see it a mile off. It was bling. The whole thing was solid. It weighed an absolute ton.
That's what I'm thinking. That must be the downside.
Not really. No, it wasn't that much that you can... It didn't cause any problems. It wasn't that heavy that you couldn't carry on your arm.
So I'm thinking you could get a frozen shoulder, trapped nerve doing that. I told Elliot that I didn't understand the allure of the £12,000 Rolex, so he took me to a fancy Glasgow jewellery shop with all the zeal with which a missionary would take a heathen to church. The sales manager showed me a £20,000 Rolex while Elliot eagerly watched. Okay.
Well, what makes this item really rather special is the brand Rolex, which is recognised and highly desired. The dial, as we call it, is available at different styles. Yes, please try on.
Okay. Gosh.
Yes, gosh. The face is available of different colours.
It's so glittery and shiny, though.
Yeah, the one had a blue face on it.
Yeah, because Elliot had one of these.
See, blue dial is very desirable. Uh-huh. This watch here, I think, maybe gives a statement that I'm maybe doing quite well.
Well, you're king of the world for that watch.
So, John, are you coming over to my...
I am actually, Elliot, I can see.
Quality, quality of manufacture.
And get a free wallet with it as well.
Oh, that's good.
Do they still do that?
Do they not do that anymore? No, I'm afraid that's not the case.
But whenever you're feeling a bit down, you can look down on your wrist and feel better about yourself.
That's precise. Well, that's quite important.
When Elliot asked me if I could now understand the attraction of the £20,000 Rolex, and I said I could, I was just being polite. It actually seems vacuous to me. By the end of 2004, when Elliot was 21, he'd defrauded the credit card companies out of something like £1 million. He was travelling around the world, first class, constantly.
My routine would usually be to, you know, get a flight to wherever I was going, check into the hotel. If I was still tired, I would have a little sleep or whatever. Then I'd get up and get dressed or go shopping or something like that usually, buy clothes and then go back to the hotel and get ready to go out and go to the pub or club, whatever.
But you were always alone?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. I spent most of that time sort of on my own.
Everybody's talking at me, I don't hear a word they're saying, only the echoes of my mind.
Then I would, you know, head out drinking, and I would always sort of buy champagne or whatever. Whatever was expensive, that's what I would buy, you know.
It sounds quite kind of empty and unproductive.
I'm not sure how productive it was, you know.
And empty?
Yeah, it was quite lonely sometimes. I'll give you that one. It certainly was quite lonely. I remember one time I just cracked up, basically. I'd been out drinking and I got back to my hotel, fell asleep and woke up in the morning thinking, you know, what am I doing? Like, what? Seriously, what am I doing? And I phoned my mum and I just sort of broke down in tears on the phone to my mum.
Everybody's talking at me, can't hear a word to say.
I'm surprised at how miserable Elliot was during his years living the high life. I wonder if it was the riches themselves that were making him unhappy. Is that what wealth does to people? Thea Willis is a wealth counsellor from Oregon. She has billionaire clients and she teaches them to be less upset and paranoid. She helps them navigate the dark side of wealth. Why did you get into this line of work?
I grew up in a wealthy family and struggled and stumbled in my 20s and noticed that many of my peers also were stumbling, and there were some tragedies, there were some deaths. And I just started thinking about it. I thought, what is this? People aspire to live in the kinds of neighborhoods where I grew up with these big, gorgeous houses. I knew that people who don't live in those neighborhoods often think, if I could just live in a house like that, I would be happy and my life would be easy. And I knew it was not an automatic equation. So I knew that expertise needed to be available. And that was why I first started to do this work.
And what about the people you knew who really became casualties of it? What happened with them?
One girl I knew died of anorexia, which, as you may know, is considered to be suicide. And another boy shot himself. He lived in the house next door, and it happened while I was home. And, you know, I just started thinking, what is this? I mean, these are people who supposedly have every opportunity available, yet clearly there is more pain and more stress than they can handle.
Have you got any clients who really hate their money?
Yes. I have had clients in my office in tears saying, I just wish I could get rid of it. And maybe
not
they're scared
hard to
get...
do.
I know. Sometimes I thought, well, you could give it to me. But no, I don't think that. I mean, I do think that, but I don't say it.
Does being rich make you paranoid because suddenly everybody wants to be your friend?
Yes, that is a big danger. I have one client, for instance, right now who has so much trouble worrying about the negative thoughts that they have about him as a rich person, that he retreats from the world at times and he doesn't see anyone. And he has to build up his strength to even interact with people again.
So this man that you're dealing with, is he becoming like a kind of hermit?
Yes, at times he does. And I know that he's making assumptions that come out of thin air. So
what does he imagine is happening?
Oh, for instance, he has a farm and he had someone come out to build a fence for him. And he said, well, of course, the minute he got there and he saw my luxury car, I knew that I was in trouble, that he was going to make all kinds of assumptions about how rich people are horrible and he was going to stick it to me on the price. And then I knew when he got up to the house and he saw the house that I have, this was all his assumption.
Did he say anything to the fence builder, or did he just kind of give him, you know, pointed glances from across the farm?
It's the pointed glances. No, he didn't say anything. And that's been some of our work together, is I have been preparing him to actually talk to the person that he imagines is hating him.
So what should he say to them?
He could ask the man about his life. So, you know, do you live around here? And do you have a family here? And, you know, where do you go on vacation? So once he does that, he could then say,
look at me in my great big house. It's terrible. It's unexpectedly terrible.
He could say that. You know, the key would be for him to be honest. He could even say, sometimes I feel self-conscious about the fact that I don't work, and here you are working hard at your fence building. And
I'm just standing here watching you build that fence.
Yeah, and that you might think bad of me. And who knows, the guy might say, are you nuts? Or he might say,
you're right, well, I'm working my ass off here and you're just standing here pointedly glaring at me.
Or he might say, you know what? I think you're really lucky. I think what you have is great. He could say that.
Or he could say, will you stop staring at me, you rich weirdo?
But the thing is, unless he engages in a conversation with this person, all he has is his own assumptions.
So he literally just sort of wanders around his farm, staring at manual laborers.
Well, that's a bit extreme. There's a little more variety in his life than that.
And did the fence builder rip him off?
No, actually, he didn't. In the end, he felt he gave him a fair price, but he had a hard time admitting that.
Thea Willis. Elliot Castro was paranoid too, and he had even more reason to be, because he was a fraudster living a lie day after day. When people he met in bars asked him where his money came from, he told them he was a hotel consultant or a doctor or a naval officer or a Canadian Secret Service agent.
The worst thing for me really was meeting people who I genuinely liked and genuinely got on with, you know. But the only thing was, they really didn't have any idea who I was. At one point I told one or two people that I was working for the Ministry of Defence in a research capacity. It was very, very difficult to form friendships with people, you know, because, I mean, there would be people that I would meet and I would, you know, really, really like these people, you know, and be great. I'd get on like a house on fire with them. But it could never be a proper relationship because they wouldn't know who I was, and it was hard. It was hard. And there were times where I came close to telling people, this is actually what I do. You can't tell people that. It's like, it would destroy any friendship, you know, because it would just be a case of that person could probably never trust you again. So there would be no point in being friends with them.
Elliot had been going around and around the world in circles like a very flash lab rat in a maze for 4 years, and the police and his mum were beginning to cotton on, and she was worried.
So being a fraudster is quite hard work. I guess it's stressful work, because you're always thinking I might get caught.
And he's got to keep all these figures and things in his head, and he's got to keep them in his head because you can't write them down. So it's got to be quite stressful, I guess, yeah.
I have to ask, Jane, though, and forgive me for asking this, but was there a time when you kind of had an inkling, you kind of knew what he was doing, but you sort of didn't say anything because he was your son?
No, there was. Elliot will tell you himself, we always asked him to stop. Please don't do that. You are going to get caught. You will get caught. But as he'll tell you, the money was so easy. It's so easy to do when you know how. And then the police come into the house. I mean, we used to really crack up. Why do you keep coming here? Elliot is not here. You know, just... Yeah, but you must know where he is. If I knew it, do you really think I'm going to tell you? I can't do that. It's my son. It's up to you to find him.
It all ended for Elliot and Harvey Nichols in Edinburgh on November the 5th, 2004. He and his personal shopper were choosing clothes, and then, suddenly, it was over.
We were only about halfway round the menswear department and I had to nip to the loo. And when I opened the cubicle, there was a guy just standing in front of me and he grabbed my arm and said, can we have a word? So I think at that point, I mean, it was all over. Basically, that's when everything just sort of caught up with me.
And how long did you spend in prison?
I got a sentence of 2 years and I spent 1 year in prison.
I've got to say, you got off very lightly.
I did.
Prison did Elliot the world of good. He realised, and I'm sure he means it, that this was no way to live his life.
I'd seen other inmates who were 50, 60, and they were still coming in and out of prison. I thought to myself, right, A, I don't want to be that person. B, I think I owe it now to myself and to my family to start behaving. And C, if I can do this, then I can go out and do something else legitimately and be successful.
Well, the whole point of it was to lead a fancy life. And if that meant spending your whole life in prison, it seems a bit self-defeating.
Exactly.
Now Elliot has found a new way to live a fancy life. He's a club DJ, regarded to be one of the best in Glasgow. He's written a memoir called Other People's Money. He's got friends now, and he's not lonely anymore, which he says is a lot better than expensive watches.
What kind of watch are you wearing now?
Oh, this is a fake Rolex. It's not the real thing, I'm afraid, but it just kind of reminds me of my previous days.
It's gold-coloured.
Yeah, it's gold-coloured, but it's not, unfortunately not the real thing. My friend brought it back from Thailand. It's a really good copy, actually.
How much does it cost?
That was about a tenner or something, I think. I like to think it's real, just to sort of fantasise to myself one more time.
John Ronson on Being Fancy was presented and written by John Ronson and produced by Simon Jacobs. It was a unique production for BBC Radio 4. Next, we'll enter Doonesbury land. I'll explain more in a minute after this.
For me, Jack Brel is the greatest singer-songwriter who ever lived. It's 30 years now since the Belgian-born chansonnier died, and also 30 years since I became hooked on his music.
Ne me quitte pas, il faut oublier tout.
With songs like this one, Ne me quitte